You're listening to a EuroCities podcast. The following talk was recorded as part of a EuroCities Working Group Migration and Integration and Working Group Children and Young People meeting on the 20th of October, 2021.
I would like now to move to our keynote speaker for today, namely Ilse Derlen, who we are very pleased to have here. Ilse is a professor at the Department of Social Work and Social Pedagogy at Ghent University, and she's also the director of the Research Center for the Social Study of Migration and Refugees. The acronym is CESMIR, if you want to look it up, also based at Ghent University. Ilse is also the co-director of the Center for Children in Vulnerable Situations, CCVS. Ilse has been involved in several research projects in the field of migration and forced migration, refugees, as well as war-affected children and adolescents. For example, this included studies on the psychological well-being of unaccompanied refugee minors, as well as trafficking of children, and also therapeutic care for unaccompanied refugee minors and more. So, Ilse, we're really interested in hearing some insights, and thanks in advance for sharing them with us. The floor is yours.
Thank you, Liam, for this very nice introduction. It's always a bit impressive if you hear people talking about your own achievements of gold, but I'm really pleased to be here. So what I would like to talk about today is our Child Move project. That is a large research project that has run over the past 5 years, still running up till next year, funded by the European Research Council on the experiences of the unaccompanied young refugees who are still, or not anymore, but or who were on the move. And I've termed this the title of this presentation, "They Connect Our Cities," because I think that this is one of the main insights into the entire of through how the entire project is that these young refugees are traveling throughout Europe, having experiences, different but also similar experiences in different cities, in different countries across Europe, and also bring those experiences to other cities and other countries. So I think it's really important to see that those young refugees kind of do not fall from the air, you could say, but really connect these cities through their own, through their trajectories in Europe. The study has started from the idea that we know quite a lot if we talk about psychological well-being of unaccompanied refugee minors. The study is looking at that particular group of young refugees fleeing without their parents. We know a lot about how pre-flight experiences impact their well-being. We also know how experiences in the settlement countries do impact their well-being, but little is known up till today on what kind of experiences they have throughout the flight, so during their transit, and how these experiences impact their well-being. So as main objectives of this study, overall objectives, is to document the experiences during that trajectory from home to host country, how these impact their psychological well-being, with a particular attention for racism, detention and reception conditions, and as such also to formulate some recommendations for policy and practice, especially regarding care and support structures. We recruited or selected participants in 4 different countries. One kind of exit country or last country before minors enter Europe, and then 2 countries at the borders of Europe, Greece and Italy, and 1 country that is more a settlement country, Belgium. In those countries, we asked participants in different settings to take part in our study. So we worked in detention centers in Libya and Greece, in centers, specific centers for unaccompanied minors in Greece, Italy and Belgium, and also in informal settings in Italy, in particular at the border between Italy and France. In those 4 countries, we selected about 50 to 100 unaccompanied minors in each of the countries, depending in terms of nationality, age and gender on the composition of unaccompanied minors, the total population in that particular country. And then we started to interview them, asking about their trajectories, where they come from, their past experiences, their current living situation, but also their future perspective. So we did interviews, in-depth interviews, and we also asked them to complete questionnaires, so to have some quantitative data on their mental health, on social support, coping strategies, trauma, and daily stressors. There's a lot to be said about the study design. I won't go into detail into that, given the time frame, because I clearly want to take you to the main findings, the first main findings of this study. So we had a first interview in those four countries with all of the miners, and then we tried to follow the miners. Not the miners that we interviewed in Libya, but the miners that we interviewed in Greece, Italy, and Belgium. And we tried to follow them wherever they went through Europe. So in over a period of 2 years' time, we tried to follow their trajectories in each of the European countries. And where we saw that the trajectories are really very diverse, mixed, and often very complex. And that is what I want, of course, to talk about with you today, about their trajectories and especially about their experiences. So I will use or tell you lots of quotes out of the interviews on different experiences, giving you a snapshot of what they have been going through over the past 2 years. So first findings of this study, first a map, a very complex map that I will show you on the trajectories of each of these, of each of our participants, showing that all of them have complex trajectories, often long trajectories, not always. Some go quite fast to their final country. Most of them have very long trajectories, taking months or even years before they reach a kind of final destination. And often we see that they don't have very linear trajectories. So they move, for example, from Senegal up to Libya with the ID, or up first to Mauritania with the ID to work there. Then they don't find a good job. They travel further to another country, then eventually end up in Libya, take the boat to Italy, then decide to stay in Italy, but still don't have good documents there or don't find the reception adequate for them. So still decide to travel on. So you see that complex trajectories, of course, often also impacted by migration policies in terms of Dublin returns to another country, lack of documents, and so on. So the trajectories are not linear. They pass through many cities, many countries, and they often stay for longer periods of time in these countries and these cities. So taking you through different experiences that they have during those trajectories, I think it's important to point out both to the more difficult experiences they had and also to the more positive experience, or the things that helped them to survive or to deal with the difficult experiences they had. And one of the striking things, of course, not a new thing. It's something that we know that has been documented in many reports, especially of NGOs, also by journalists, has been quite well documented. But it's also very prevalent in our studies. In our study, is the impact and the difficult experiences related to detention on the one hand, and to violence on the other hand. And violence here is violence both by border guards or other people who are in a kind of official position, like police and so on, but also violence by other civilians, by social workers in care structures, so different types of violence. Talking about this detention, I'll start with those two quotes. I had to pay $2,000 within 25 days, but I didn't pay, so I was sold to another smuggler. And my debt rose from $2,000 to $3,000. I was in a detention center. There, if you don't pay, they won't give you food, water, and they will torture you every 5 or 6 days. They arrested me in a certain place. They took me at the police station and took away my shoes. Then they locked me with other people in a cell. We were around 40 people, children and adults, some sleeping on the floor. If you were asking for something, the police officer would be beating you or kicking you with boots. So detention, even if it's forbidden for unaccompanied minors, is still often the case. We did interviews in the detention center in Amitaliza near Athens. We did many interviews in the detention centers in Libya, but also the others talked about different types of detention, be it in a real, so-called real detention center, or be it in police cells or other forms of detention. So detention is still quite frequent and of course has big impact on their well-being. This is a picture of Amygdaliza, how that detention center near Athens looks like. Other types of violence, many accounts of sexual violence, especially in Italy, we had a specific emphasis on Nigerian victims of trafficking. So especially in this sample, there were many accounts of sexual violence, but also in the other in the other groups, the non-Nigerians, we also had quite some accounts of sexual violence, either still in Africa or in Libya, but also in Europe. In Libya, I had no choice. I had to date the guys who have a connection house, or else I would have nowhere to stay or food to eat. And by force, I must have sex with him every day, whether I like it or not. It was painful. I suffered. Our container has no door, no windows. In the night, drunk men are coming to the minor section and they hit the containers with sticks to scare us. I'm always afraid to sleep. Many accounts also of stigma and discrimination, also in Europe. I will keep on stressing that to just indicate also that that is not something that only happened outside Europe, but it's often very prevalent in the European context too. Once you're Nigerian here in Italy, they think you're a prostitute. It's normal here. Police, a longer quote also on police violence, because it is quite important, I think, to pay enough attention to this. The police stopped us there and they took us our mobiles, our power banks, and they left us only the clothes we were wearing. They hit us right there and then they asked for cars to come and take us. Then they took us to the police station and there they took our fingerprints and they asked if there was a minor. And I said, I am. They asked if we have a proof that we are minors. When they were asking, we gave them the cards we had from the camp that we are minors. They had scissors and they cut those documents. They were telling us to write down that we are over 18 and told us, don't forget, if you don't sign, we have other ways to make you sign. We can hit you. We can make you sign by force. Remember that we can do whatever we want. And when they deport you, they hit you really bad. They don't look where they are hitting. They hit you anywhere they can. I was injured really badly on my feet at the sole and a lot of blood was coming out. Age determination and age is a big issue in unaccompanied minors. Also in our study, we came across minors who indicated that they were minor. At the second interview, they indicated they were older and the other way around. Many did tell that at one moment or several moments in their trajectory, their age was not noted in a correct way. So it was like you can see here, they had other documents, their documents were cut, another age was written down with related lack of protection measures, of course. So age is the big issue. And of course, I don't need to tell that, but we all know that if you're 17 or if you're 19, it doesn't make such a big difference in what kind of needs you might have and what kind of support you might need. So age is still, I think, a very tricky thing, especially with that real kind of threshold at 18, and which has a lot of impact on the cares and support you still can have. And I think we also as cities, we need to think around that. We need to see how we can bridge the gap that is created at that with that threshold, and as such also make sure that still the appropriate support is given to those who are in need of certain support. Looking at their mobility, and these are findings from Ossian Uzuro, one of the researchers, we see that she did research on the Italian group, not the Nigerians, but the other Italian unaccompanied minors who were selected in Italy. And she looked at how the trajectories, you've seen the complex graphic on the trajectories, how the mobility of her unaccompanied minors does evolve over time. And on one hand, she saw lots of geographical mobility, meaning that the participants entered Italy and directly or after a certain amount of time, they went further on in Europe. And on the other hand, there were also minors who stayed, which we termed as a kind of social mobility. So they tried to reach a certain upward mobility in their social position in Italy. In the geographical mobility group, we saw that there is quite a group that has a very direct trajectory. So they have a particular view on the country they want to go to, often impacted by family members who are staying in a certain country, and they immediately travel through Italy, and as fast as possible, they try to get to their final destination. On the other hand, there are also quite some interrupted trajectories. So minors who decide to stay, for example, in Italy, try to apply for documents or cared for in a particular care structure, but then because they don't have the documents or they don't like the care structure that they're living in, or their family members do advise them to travel to another country, they decide to travel further. So you see often these kind of interrupted trajectories with sometimes long stays in particular countries before they decide to travel further and to reach up to another country. So an account of a Tunisian boy in Italy on his interrupted trajectory: upon my arrival, they promised to proceed with my documents, but they didn't keep their promise. The shower is once a week and the food is not good. The pocket money was given every 2 weeks. In the center, you have to accept the situation. You have no right to claim anything. So here, I think in this account, supported by many others, we already learn what is important for minors in a particular care structure. So we're talking about very basic things, what we call the material stressors or the lack of material stressors. They get documents, and I will show you also in a minute the social support that is really important also in their decision to stay or to travel further. But also familial networks have a big impact, as is shown in the following quote. I have some family in Germany and Spain. My uncle in Germany refused to help me, and I received no answer from my uncle in Spain. He stopped all contact when I told him I was going to France. So also family plays a very diverse role. Sometimes they are very receptive. Sometimes they are receptive at the first sight, but then decide to not anymore care for the boy or the girl, or to stop caring for the boy or the girl. So also that might strongly impact their trajectories. Social mobility. So deciding to stay and to try to find a social mobility upwards in the country of settlement is often impacted by documents. So if they have documents, they often decide to stay. And they also do what we saw in the interview, large efforts themselves to create and own upward social mobility. So they try to create better lives through seeking for good education, to try to find a job and earn some money, but also to engage on all kinds of social events and activities. Like this boy, Seydou, talking about his sports club, football. When I'm at the football field, there is a field at Ballaro here. When I got there, the white children, the little ones, many of them come and call me, Seydou, we are coming. Because when I go there, I have fun with all of them. So when I come there, they call me, Seydou, they run, we play, we do everything together. And after them, often even the mothers come to look at us. Ah, it's you, my child, he comes to play with you here. They often talk to me about you at home. You see? So you see that there's lots of investment to connect with the local environment, with the local social networks, and as such also to find a kind of belonging and own position. And in some cases also they hope that engagement will also help to get them some documents by the national government. Also here, familial networks are again very important in the final decision to stay and what they should do in a particular country. in care structures, looking at what is important in care structures, what they like in care structures and what helps them is first the fact that they have to do something. I think that is really an important aspect. Having something to do during the day, having a meaningful activity, preferably school, but also other activities, is really important to help them also to avoid thinking too much, to worry more. Much to love or to miss their family too much. So one participant friends and so just to make myself it's like do nothing which of course in family important aspect but it's often related to missing their families. Every night I have bad dreams. I dream about my family. For me, it's difficult to go to bed and sleep. Still, I think, and that's a problem I have and things in my mind. I don't need a psychologist. I know I have a problem and this and that, but the only thing that can heal me is my family with me. I wish my mom was here even for one day. What is also important, and I think that there's something, because many of those things, as a local city council or a community in a city, we do not always have impact onto different of those things. But one of the most protective factors that we found in our study is everything that relates to social support in a very diverse way. First, there's the importance of good and accessible information. We saw in many care structures that certain languages or participants speaking certain languages have less access to information than other participants speaking other languages. So giving them good and accessible information is really important to be able to make informed decisions on whether to stay, whether to travel further, what to do, and as such having some control over your life. So importance of information. Second, importance of peer support. Not only peer support in the local settings or in the local care structure where they live, but also the new peers that they start to meet while being on their way to a particular country. So that was for me quite new finding is that they really connect to new people while traveling and keep those connections. So it's not because one ends up in France and the other one in Belgium that they lose contact. They still try to be in contact, especially in the first phase of the settlement. Some quotes to illustrate the importance of peers. The first quote in French. Mon meilleur ami fait moins que je tiens à cœur. Il n'est pas ici, il est en France. Moi, c'est lui. Mais j'ai beaucoup d'amis. Quand j'ai des difficultés, je les appelle, je les demande aussi des conseils. C'est les amis que j'ai connus pendant mon parcours. Puis on est resté en contact par Facebook. If you're alone, lonely, then you think about those past experiences. But when you are with your friends, then you forget those things. Yeah, the most important is about his family, that is for his family, and too, when he transports to another center, that he will have little money to buy a cell phone, to make Facebook, to make a contact with them. So that's the most important to him. So again, contact with family, being able to contact your family, to call regularly is really important. We also looked at the quantitative data, and if we look at how mental health evolves over time, so what are the factors that do impact their long-term mental health, then we see that next to past traumatic events and traumatic experiences along the way, also daily stressors impact their mental health, and especially daily social stressors. So if they experience more difficulties to connect or to create a network, or if they experience more difficulties of stigma and discrimination, they also have more mental health on the longer term. So again, here we see at the kind of negative side, you could say, how important social support is, and how also I think as a local community, as a local city, we can do a lot to create and support the establishments of new social networks. And we also saw that the support they receive from social workers, but also from civilians and volunteers, is really important. If you look, and that those are findings from a study from Malte Behrendt and Oceanu Zorro, if you look at the support that they receive by volunteers while being on the move, that's really an important part. They receive from volunteers, they receive material support, they receive information and guidance, but they also hope and encouragement and emotional attachment. On the material support, a quote just to illustrate that, some people came and gave me food, some people came and gave me water, and I was actually hungry and thirsty, and I didn't find any money to buy food. On information, she helped me a lot because she is the one who showed me the asylum procedure, how to apply for asylum until I came to the center here. And we often see that those connections with volunteers remain important. Even if they only encountered a volunteer for one night, they only stayed one night in his or her home, still they value that connection and they often repeatedly connect that volunteer. You don't have a brother, you don't have a family, you don't have your own house, but when people receive you as a guest and they trust you to stay with them overnight, that's the best experience. The unconditionality of that kind of support, trusting people without asking any question, without also asking any or giving any advice or any pressure on how to proceed with the trajectory is a very important aspect of support. And that is, for me, as a conclusion, one of the most important things that they do not only connect our cities, but cities can also be important places of hospitality. We have learned a lot about the French philosopher Derrida on how cities can be places of hospitalities and how be a guest and be an unconditional guest, which is a very difficult term in a way, but be received with unconditional support is a very important aspect. And in overall context, migration context, national and European and worldwide migration context, which is often quite difficult for these youngsters, I think in the city, both on the government side of the city and on the community side of the city, we can create those places of hospitalities and be of large importance, not only for those who settle in our city or our country, but also for those who still or in transit. That is still, I think, really meaningful to also think about support for that group. I will leave it here. Thank you very much for your attention.
This has been a EuroCities podcast. Find us at eurocities.eu. Thanks for listening.